Can there be order in this meeting? We have one apology here, and it comes from Anson Deval Albert. It reads, "Ben, I would be available for meeting on Wednesday. Kindly submit my apology to the chair for tomorrow." And the only apology we have. Let us look at the recommendation. Recommendation 8.1. Is this in order, and what time frame can we put to this one? Honorable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that if we're going point by point, then 8.1, I think that the point is in order, but I think this should start immediately. It's an ongoing, it's a role of overseeing the performance of the entity, so it should be ongoing immediately. It's an ongoing thing. So there isn't really a beginning and an end, there's just a beginning on this recommendation.
Ongoing, but then we need to get a report. Do we say quarterly report or monthly report? That's the recommendation. Ongoing, and those quarterly reports I think from which quarter? I think we need to have it.
Thank you. Jefferson, I don't think we should say agreements are signed timeously. We should say agreements are signed within the allocated time, because there's a cut-off date for this. So they could sign it timeously after the cut-off date. So they must be within the allocated time, because there's a cut-off date. And what happens is they don't sign it. I don't know what the cut, but there is a cut-off date because the Public Service Commission does a review of this annually to say which departments have signed and which departments haven't, and which managers have signed and which haven't.
Much aware of this deadline, other than cut-off date, that they should sign things before the deadline. Yeah.
We can even have another one that we need to get quarterly report. In the quarterly report, this one's a standing item. And their contract, I think we should discuss what five, monitor the use of consultants and ensure that there are comprehensive programs aimed at transferring skills to permanent staff. Honorable Williams.
Chairman, I think this should be reported to the committee on a biannual basis every 6 months.
Okay, that is done. Set an example and please vacate the address on this PES system. That we should lead by example. Honorable Mbaz, by when? Today, December. Because while we're running a public employment system, we can't seem to be advertising the junior posts in the newspapers when we encourage everybody else to advertise through our system. I think we need to lead by a company. And maybe let's say in the next tranche of jobs to be advertised in the department should be done through the public employment.
We should say starting from the next tranche of jobs we advertise. Maybe they'll assume it's effective to do it once, then we'll be happy. So it's starting from that and continuing into the future, every cycle.
Okay.
I suppose it depends on the vacancy. Some of the senior vacancies take a little longer, so I'm not too worried about the 6 months that we have there, but yeah, I'm open to suggestions. 9 months would be more or less about right if you're doing it correctly through the channel. So
that we could say the process should have got a little bit starting in January, and then the process should be completed by the end of the calendar year 2013, which means 31st December.
Or maybe add something that we should have the corridor, the it is pending item in all our meetings with the department, starting from January, so that we get briefing about this all the time. Each time we meet with the department, they must know, they need to brief us about this. And this will not only the COIL, but even including the public private, the cement and
my understanding about this recommendation is that you are specifically saying that they must commission a site. And if they are going to commission a site, you must get a report on that site on a particular day. So instead of talking, you can't talk about the site every meeting, say how far are you in the study, how far. We happen to be able to say, at least by the end of October next year, they must provide us with a report of that particular study. So whatever they do in the meantime, they know that on a particular day, they must report on that particular study.
Include the model used by these companies such as McKinney, the private companies that pay out claims on behalf of medical aid, because those are so efficient in such a way that with no money that you can lost along the line of claiming and double claims and so forth. So I don't know exactly how are we going to include this, but we wanted a study along those lines so that we are able to determine whether we really need compensation funds to be operating as a government entity, or we would use the model like GEMS is a government owned medical aid, but GEMS administration is done by Medicare. So along those lines, there aren't any hindrances or issues of money being double paid or people not getting their money and doctors not getting their claims and doctors colluding with all this thing. So I don't know how exactly to put it in English, but one of the studies was something like this, a model, especially an example was made like the GEMS model, because Meskin is an administrating there, to say part of the study, what they need to come to us with a study on us maybe trying or commending that a compensation fund uses such models. I rest my case and say before I continue to speak English.
Get our interprint. I'll be your interprint. You don't need the interprint. But you know, if people look back up in the way, case in the newspaper about COIL have been taken to court by some of the doctors. Through the American Comsol. And Comsol won many cases against the department, where they ended up needing to pay. Each time they were taken to court, they would lose the case and pay. But why can't, you know, maybe we need to get briefings about those ones too. And even what I'd like to do, mention med scheme and many other systems that the doctors use when they want to keep for their citizens. But we're going to do, maybe we should pray to the department that they should do that for us. And then maybe that will help us again to understand and give direction on where should the COIL go. Honorable Nyakemba, let me see the hand again. Honorable Mata Makwena Mashela and the
is that Nyakemba?
Yeah, I'm saying. forget about that.
Sir, I think Honorable Khanare tried to cover everything that we're trying to raise now. Because for me, we must not complicate the process. As much as that time frame that is put by Honorable Khanare, I think we might, in the process, if we just want a brief, after some time, but I think that time frame that he put, we mustn't complicate it. Let me say it like that. I don't want to comment to what Honorable Marcel Makubele said, but I don't remember us taking that decision. So we for me, we must live with what Honorable Fernando has suggested. Thank you.
All members here, they have
have interest on how on resolution of this problem of COIDA. I think we need to find a way of pushing COIDA faster in the next quarter. We sit and look at what they do and see what we can do to help them. And then the last one would be 8-10. Honorable Hanan.
I don't know. What informs us to say why do you believe that the study can take a why not 6 months? I'm not asking about because if it can take 6 months to finish the study, why do they take a year? Because what you want is the result. I'm not agreeing with 12 months, but I can. It's like some psyching. What informs us about it? Why do we believe that this study will take 12 months? I think the best way is to say we want you to conduct this particular study. Tell us in January what steps are you going to take to ensure that this study takes place, and then based on that, we then say we want you to finish by this. We might ask the departments to be in charge of that, not quite not the Conservation Commission themselves, but the department must tell us about how long.
No, you're not taking us back. What is a baby? You're taking us forward. And I can see you put something.
I think by the time we take a decision on whether it's 6, 12, or 24, the study will be available.
Okay, they'll give us a report by before the end of January. About what programs they have in place. It's done. The last one, ensure that the inspection and enforcement services branch reports on the progress made in addressing the challenges associated with the infrastructure of the inspectorate. This will be a quarterly thing. Starting from January. Honorable Nyakem.
I'd like to check something to whether are we having the same understanding. The structure, are we referring to the specialization which the sport inspectorate wanted to order the department structure?
No, there's a new structure that is in place now. Now, what we want to check is what progress are we making in addressing the challenges that are arising, that are happening because of the new structure. Our criteria that we need this report in the second week of February so that we don't file everything in January.
Which January?
Honorable Mr.
Chairman, are we talking about this January that is definitely 2018 or the one that is in 2014?
January we talked about is January 2030. We talk about 2030. The next January Honourable members, let's move in. We completed the LRA on Thursday, and now the matters that were put in the parking lot, now we're unpacking them, and the Parliament legal team will give us the briefs that we, the opinions that we requested, and legal advice from our legal. There are no Bush lawyers. There are no Bush lawyers who will be listening attentively. So get ready for more questions. There are many of us Bush lawyers here today. Thank you. Who's good? Dr. Nuss?
Thank you.
potentially legal for them from today, for which the process becomes extremely technical, because the wording documents before us, members will sit on top, what is the yellow documents in color, so the yellow will show us what's in the bill and the grey is what is proposed to change. Now, that is a deliberation process for the committee. Ultimately, what needs to come out of this process is a document that looks like this. And we've started and taken the liberty. This is not foolproof, because this is informed by what members decide. And this is an A-list. And this is an extremely technical document which speaks. I've just started to look at all the amendments and the working list, but this will have to change. But this takes almost 2 days to sit and do from a legal drafting. This took me Saturday and Sunday to do from a legal drafting perspective. So this is not something that's done in 10 minutes. And that's why we're saying to the committee that if a clause is there or discussed today, just to give an indication, do a provisional A-list. Not a fully agreed A-list. Then at least we can start working on this document, which takes many days to do, and this document is being the one where members will review the ruler clause by clause, and we say in numbers of the bill, and that, but this document takes very long to do. And if we don't get instructions or at least a guide for it, we could be asking for another weekend.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to concur with my colleague that yes, it's a very technical process, and I think it's a way forward to assist us to moving forward with A-list and to prevent us from going over the same things that we agreed on where there are no issues. So I think maybe it's a way forward, and I'd like to propose that the committee consider that we, like Dr. Lutzer said, when we deal with Clause 1, if the committee agrees to it, we say, okay, agree. That doesn't preclude the committee from coming back or making the changes, but will assist us in drafting and moving forward, so that at least when we come back, we can at least say, okay, this is the end of stuff, or these are issues agreed upon, these are the proposed amendments that the committee wishes to make. Thanks.
Absolutely not disagreement. All I think that we say is, let's go through the whole report, let's get the presentation, we'll make our notes as the process goes. And we will do that. We will definitely have to do that. But all I'm saying is that let's not do it during the presentation. Let's do it later on when the presentation has been done and we've absorbed the entire presentation. Thanks, Chair.
Dr.
Lewis,
or is there?
I think what we're discussing here is whether there are legal issues in terms of the language, not accepting that we as a party or committee agree with the clause. I think that is what they're trying to get at, that the clause is, like for instance, if they said clause 1, there is no legal issue. In other words, we agree with that. That, in other words, it's written simply and we can understand it. It doesn't mean that we agree with what it says. We just agree that there is no issue for them to look at, and then at the later time we can decide whether we support it or we don't support it. That is my understanding.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. With this permission, then, I would like to just turn the members' attention to Clause 3. We have the explanatory note there. They just highlight that even though the amendment requires a policy decision and does not amount to legal question, our colleagues from the department requested an additional amendment, a consequential amendment, if this clause is approved by the committee or accepted. The clause will add additional responsibilities to the minister, which will then also, they had a request that the time frame in the Principal Act, instead of 60 days, become 90 days. So we just drafted a proposed new insertion. In the event that a committee member, if minister would like to accept this policy proposal by the department, to also amend for an extension in days. That's just a contrast to how we're dealing with the amendment which follows. It's not a legal issue, but following the department's request, that there may be a consideration for a consideration amendment in the Principal Act, the two sections 32.
seeing as the proposed clause will add responsibility to the water and then will request for additional time to give effect to those responsibilities. Permission here, I would then like to turn to clause 4. Similarly, we had no legal issues identified there. And then clause 5, Mrs. Ray's concerns as to whether this clause was necessary at all, as it says levies and fees to be charged by bargaining councils, and as our colleague in this part pointed out, the CTMA currently, they don't charge those fees, but the clause links this as a over the top, where the cap for fees that the bargaining council can ask to those of the CTMA. We did a quick read through the LRA just to determine whether necessity for such a clause plays a role here. The LRA in sections 123, 138, 140 and 147 gives that possibility, the competency to the CTMA to charge their dignity, and also says it is in exceptional circumstances. So the mere fact that the CTMA does not at the moment do so doesn't imply that it may never do so. So as far as we read clause 5, it is merely to align for future practical purposes. And that if the CTMA decides to do something, the bargaining council can similarly align their practices. I want to mention a person, and that's just for comparative information, I think, with the clause references in. It ultimately comes down to a policy decision and not legal question. That's all done. Then clause 6, Chair. We previously responded to the committee's request to look at the ballot system under the 1956 LRA. And as pointed out at the beginning, this is a working document. We are at the office a few hours this morning, and we just discussed again this ballot system issue. And our concern with the 1956 case was raised was the technicality, the challenge on technicality. Upon further reflection this morning, we actually think if neither can just turn to clause 8 in the bill, that from a technicality perspective or a technicality challenge to ballot, the wording in clause 8 for an amendment to section 67 and clause 8A, the amendment to clause section 67 in the LRA may be sufficient to curb that challenge to technicality. Therefore, to remain the policy decision as indicated previously, whether to reintroduce such a ballot system or not, ultimately for the committee. So just to indicate to members the writing in the working document, the document is said by this comment that clause 8 is sufficient, or appears to be sufficient to curb the technicality challenge that may arise. Commission Chairman, clause 7, similarly no legal issues identified. And that is the case right through from clause 8 to clause 12. In clause 13, members raised concerns or requested clarity as to public officials exercising authority in the name of the state, why such a clause would be appropriate or needed to be addressed in the LRA. This is in line with the International Labour Organization's provision. I included a reference to the Freedom of Association and Protection of the Right to organize convention, in which similar wording is used and expression is given. So with this clause, it's merely bringing the LRA on par with the ILO standard or the International Labour Organization standard. Once again, that the inclusion or that move remains a decision in the hands of the committee and not a legal one. Then in clause 14, it speaks to section 72 of the LRA. And it makes provision for the application of section 74 through section 72. This commission wants to provide for the most principal action. Disputes in essential services. committee members were concerned as to why Parliament as an institution would be able to step in or play a role when an arbitration award or is made in the essential services context. That was also linked, I think, that can air out into 16 discussions as well. Parliament's role almost as a supervisory function. Why would there be a need for that? And our interpretation, Chairperson, is that it's because of the financial implications. If an award is made with essential services, that can have that in itself, any award that is in favour of more pay or rights or for something that's impact on the public interest and the public service, that can have financial implications. And therefore, Parliament has a role to play when an award is made that has financial implications, because it touches the public pocket. So it's a check and balance. The Constitution always talks about checks and balances between the executive and the legislature and the judicial services. Well, Section this is also a similar check and balance. There's financial implications if essential services use result in the award. Therefore, it's almost like, I think the term was used as an advisory obligation award. It's advised there should be the outcome or the party should agree to settle on these things. Given permission, I would move. Would I stop and would you then like to ask Sarah's question?
Let's do it this way, yeah? Are there members who would like to ask further questions of class on this one? But maybe we ask Dr. Liu to explain this one this time in English.
Chairperson, then maybe I should make reference specifically to In Principle Act, Section 7245, which says any arbitration award in terms of Section 4, which is dispute, the unresolved disputes and the essential services, may in respect of the state, and that has financial implications for the state, become binding 14 days after the date of the award, unless a minister has tabled the award in Parliament in that period, or 40 days after the date of tabling of the award, and then Parliament has passed the resolution that the award is not binding. The reason why we commented on this in the working document is not because it is in the bill, the clause itself, because members raised the concern by when our colleagues in the department explained where the clause fits in, reference was made to Parliament's role. The minister placed it in context, and the question was posed, why did Parliament have this supervisory, the power to step in as an institution when it's clearly about an award and there's a dispute and it's an essential services. And what we try to do here is just highlight that the reason, our interpretation is, the reason appears to be because it's financial implications. Financial implications of the country and its pocket. So that just plays the clause in context. So when members come to decide on the policy issue, the context is.
Thank you again. And show how this issue emerged, because this was the matter raised by Honorable Nyakema when he was saying that now suddenly the advice is no longer good for your advisor. Parliament makes laws that when these judgments are made by this body, everybody has to follow. But when it's affecting Parliament, it says no. We can still say no, you were wrong. Maybe let's have a re-look at the issue. So that's how it was. That's how it came into being. Just to take, to remind members about where this one came from. I think we should push on because we come to an example.
Between clause 15 and 16, similarly, none identified. For clause, Secretary Chair, I'm going to hand over to Advocate Gordon.
In clause 17 of the bill, Advocate Gordon, for the record. Feels currently that their position is threatened in any case. Coming back to clause 17, the issue that came up during the preliminary discussion committee centered on 103A sub 4 and it was about foresee the administrative fees, whether or not the administrative fees are a first charge against the assets drafted in the bill. And having looked at that, Section 103 of the Principal Act of the LRA deals with the winding up of the trade unions or employee organizations. And what 103.4 says is that the Registrar of Labour Court must determine the liquidation. The Labour Court in Chambers may review the determination of fees by the Registrar and see the liquidated fees are first charged against the assets of the trade union. So it seems as if 4C was almost a carbon copy of Section 103.4 in the Principal Act in respect of the liquidated fees. Now, when we're talking about administration, it's a process, if we speak in the ambit of company law, it's a process prior to liquidation. A trade union in this context is in financial stress, and we want to appoint an administrator. The purpose of that administrator is to attempt to revive that trade union or employee organization. An administrator is not brought in to kill the trade union, so let's salvage it and see if we can turn it around. And if that process is successful, we can't talk about a first charge, because a first charge, and that's not a good word, but in company law we would speak of preference creditors, secured creditors, concurrent creditors. But essentially what that first charge means is that I'm preference. Now it means I rank on top of the list to get paid. Now in a liquidation, a liquidator, that is what Section 103 of the Principal Act refers to. So when we have a liquidator that's appointed, that liquidator would have to do an L&D. That's just a legal acronym for liquidation and distribution account, or an LLC, liquidation and contribution account, if the estate has no funds, the creditors would contribute. If the estate does have funds, the wind-up estate, it is a distribution. Money goes out to creditors. Now, that, when we speak of a first charge, it can only imply that there's a liquidation in process. But when a trade union employees organization is under administration, there's no L&D. The administrator steps into the shoes of the person who ordinarily would be in management of the trade union or the employees organization to salvage. And for that instance, the administrator fees are paid by the trade union or employees organization. Now, in the working document, what I've done on page 5, I've proposed under the Graybit to reword C in 103 capital A on page 5 of the working document. The year is what's currently in the bill, and that's 9 bold, to possibly be taken out if members agree, and to be replaced by the new CND. And what that is if the administration process does not result in the winding up of the trade union or employer's organization as contemplated in section 103, that's of the Act, the administrative fees will be paid as an expense against the assets of the trade union or employee's organization. Because it cannot be a first charge. It's not a liquidation yet. In company law, this is what is called judicial management. D would then, if the administration process results in the winding up of the trade union or employee's organization, the administrative fee will rank with the fee of the liquidator in terms of section 103.4C. So in that respect, where the administration process cannot salvage a trade union or an employer's organization, and indeed a liquidation imminent, then those fees are rank equal to that of the liquidator in the L&D account. That is the proposal issue.
Okay, Honourable Van der Goes, please.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much. Because, as you remember, I had a bit of a problem with the original wording here. But now I must tell you that the words will be paid as an expense against the assets. I also have a bit of a question mark regarding that, because isn't it possible that there may still be income? And it's really necessary then to have the word against the assets. If the legal team could just comment on that, please.
Okay.
Liquidator versus administrator
issue in that if you find an administrator and the process end cannot be implemented and you've got to liquidate, assumes that the administrator will take the responsibility of being a liquidator. The clarity I need is if you have an administrator who was appointed to salvage a trade union and the process fails, and inevitably you have to liquidate, which means that a liquidator has to come in to wind up that process. If that's the case, then it talks to the necessity of point D, whether is it necessary to make that inclusion if somebody else takes over. I don't know if that makes sense. Yeah.
The other end from the members, Mkali?
We do not have difficulty with this proposal, but I think that the issue that we want to give to members is that the intention of this action, it might not be capturing this now, because we've never had a winding up of a trade union. We've never applied to wind up any trade union. This rescue is a rescue before deregistration. We deregister as many trade unions in the organization, but not wind them up. That process has never taken place. Now, what Regis was trying to do here was trying to say that in certain cases, there could be a case to assist the union instead of deregistering it. It's not about winding up and liquidation. That was not the intention of this section. This section was supposed, the intended action was to try to give the register, where it is necessary, an extra that the register might see a trade union, but it's a German trade union that might be struggling to have its own in order. And instead of deregistering, because that's the first step, the deregistration process, instead of deregistering it, assist it to deal with that problem. And the only way sometimes to assist is to go to court and apply for an administrator. Although I can see that the memorandum links it to section 1.3, and that the colleagues are correct in linking it, but that was not the intention of introducing this. It was not intended to be introduced as the first step to liquidation. It's intended to introduce it as the first step, when possible, to deregistration, then to liquidation. And because those process of liquidation, we've never had the experience of having to apply for union liquidation. That is not taking place. I just wanted to put that so that it might assist to debate the law with the context in terms of what it is that we're trying to bring in terms of that.
There's something about, again, the spirit and the intention of the law. Are there issues that members would like to raise on, or some comments on this one? Because you advocate on.
Thank you, Chair. The first issue was that the fees will be paid as an expense against the assets. I indicated that the working document, it was just a sort of the top of our heads, it wasn't costing insurance, so the members are not happy with that, and it's just an expense, as any expense would lie in the day-to-day function of a trade union or employer's organization. That draft can obviously reflect that. The issue with the liquidator and the administrator, we must remember in judicial management, in the ambit of company law, the person appointed as administrator is not necessarily the liquidator. That's appointed at a time when a formal application is made for first and final orders of liquidation. Similarly, we must also remember that in the event, while the department has indicated that no trade union or employees organization today has ever found itself within the ambit of Section 103, we can't say that it will never ever happen. We don't know what lies in the future. But having stated that, Section 104 of the Principal Act speaks of when there's an application for winding up, and that application is taking place in terms of the Insolvency Act. So that really gives emphasis to the fact that the administrator and the liquidator would not be the same person. also hearing the department on the issue of the fact that the introduction of Section 103A in the bill is designed as a precursor to deregistration. That being the case, I think that needs to come out more clearly possible in the draft. Safe to say that there are two scenarios in 103A, sub 2. It says, and trade union or employer organization fails materially to perform its functions, and that is a financial restriction. Those are really, but it says without limiting. So yes, the administration process could be seen as a precursor to deregistration, but we must keep in mind that when we're looking at a broader application of law, administration would usually be a precursor to managing whatever entity to keep them out of liquidation or to keep them out in a bad process. I'm fine with that, but we should take into account that for purposes of 103.4c, where the initial concern laid by the members is that that draft is incorrect, it cannot be a first charge, and even if we keep the clause entirely, that then at least the proposal is that 4c of the working document be kept, taking into account the changes proposed, that it shall not lie against the assets, but only as an expense against the trade union or employees organization. Thank you.
Honorable Khanat.
Look, my other thing was also to say, look, we have got to encourage people to become administrators if they are appointed to be administrators. Because if they are not guaranteed that they will be paid, then there will be nobody will be willing to come forward to become an administrator, and therefore the objective of saving the union will not be realized. That's point number one. Number two, I had raised the issue, Chairperson, when we were discussing about the administrator being kept accountable so that the administrator does not now become permanent because they are getting paid. That's the two issues which I wanted to raise.
Honorable Honorable.
Thank you very much. I will agree with the last part of the permanent administrator. There are practical cases now subsidiaries of unions which were in administrator have been there for quite some time. So I think it's important that we find a way as to maybe you may not be able to in law determine the period. Maybe you can determine the period in which an administrator can be put in place. So maybe we need to think about that. But my initial question on point C is, if the administrator and the liquidator are not the same person, and the liquidation process is determined in terms of Section 103, is there a necessity for us to have that point of Section B as a proposed amendment? Because you've got another section in the law which determines the liquidation process and all of that. And inevitably, if the liquidation process kicks in, it means you need a liquidator and therefore no longer need an administrator. So you don't have to, I don't think you need that section.
Actually, I think to the honourable member before I start, I did make a suggestion that the same CNSB is not taken forward. I think also just to point out for clarity, the administrator did not have carte blanche to do as he or she. If you look at 103(8), the administrator is appointed by the court. And so the court will set the parameter time frame for that administration. So it's not like this administration process will go on forever. The court will possibly order say that if we're taking the union under administration for 18 months, the administrator has to do X, Y, and Z. The intimidated court will be X, Y, and Z. And then in terms of sub 5, the labor court will then determine whether to really amend or to do away with the administration. Thank you, Chair.
The problem I have is that the court will rely on recommendations from the administrator. to determine whether it is a receipt of the tools. I'm just saying it's a practical thing. When you determine, when you appoint an administrator, and you determine what determines the period of that administrator after what the court has given, is the court of the administrator. And the court will say, I trust this administrator. He has no reason to want to be there for any longer than the intention to get this union functioning properly. But the administrator can have a different behavior, because, I mean, if I'm paying a lot of money for, which I will not do if I continue with my practice, I'm incentivized to increase my period so that I can solve this problem permanently. That's where my problem lies. And what we are talking about here, it is my own experience, and I'm not talking about, I'm not lying. I think right administrator is there later now, after 7 years or 10 years. More than 10 years, that the administrator who was appointed to be administrator discovered that there is more money in the minister in here than whatever I can make when I'm doing my job. And therefore, I'm encouraged. So because it's not accountable to anybody except giving reports which justify why they should call it. That's really my concern, that this thing of trust does not always just work on trust.
I'll agree with Honorable Khanale, because there are lots of such cases now that are creating problems, case of administrators in the Northwest, but well, administrators of the tier account, of the tier accounts in local government, those of traditional authorities. You know, many traditional authorities in the Northwest are run administration, and some of these administrators, when I worked there in 2010, some administrators were there. They've been there for 3 years, and I'm told they are still, the administrators are still running the show. You know, so there must be somehow where we say, no, this person cannot, you can't be an administrator forever. There must be a cutoff somewhere. And if your interventions are not bearing any fruit, then we've got to get rid of you and get another administrator. Honorable Mukari.
Chair, I think this might help. If you look at 103C, it's the registrar that applies to the court to put the union or employee organization on administration. I think if we change 5, instead of allowing the administrator to go to court, it should be the registrar, I mean, that goes to court. Again, if the registrar wants to amend the order, he should not give the administrator that power to go to court, and then that will deal with this issue. The registrar should just be appointed. He should not have a law of standing in court to amend the order. The person that went to court to get the order should be the person. If the registrar report, if the administrator reports to the registrar, say, I need more time on this because of this reason, then the registrar must go to court and show court why. And the registrar, remember, is an independent person. He's not interested, he's not getting paid the money. His interest is to make sure that the union operates. If the administrator comes back and they say this is a story, when it's not a story, if the registrar does his job properly, he should be able to say, no, I'm not going to court, finish this one. I'm not going to court on that. And I think that if we make that change, it will give the protection that the man is talking about.
I really feel comfortable with the Bush lawyer's suggestion.
All in the boardroom. You are all in the boardroom. No one is in the bush. No. Yeah. Oh, remember, let's take a 10-minute break. Please, that's it.
Gracias.
No, they are the ones who are making the presentation, and then we'll get an advice from state law advisors here. Don't put words in my mouth.
What language is that? I'm speaking language.
To teach children to speak English in America. Professor of English coming from Ambassador. Over to you, Dr. Lewis.
Thank you, Chair.
Chair,
we're on to with eight, and we're from 1870, no legal issues identified. So, Commissioner, I'm moving on to clause 19. Our colleagues from the department briefly made reference in their discussion or presentation on this clause to members last week of a recent judgment that was given in the High Court, I think to North Gauteng High Court, on representation. So we just, to make sure that this was aligned, we need to go look at the court case. It was the Lord Society of the Northern Province versus Minister of Labour and others. The case did make reference to Section 113(2) capital A case in the Principal Act, and that now is a clause, or a section that clause 19 proposes to amend. So for that reason, we went to double check it. In that case, it was not the clause itself or the principle in that section that was attacked, but the constitutional validity of the rule that the CTMA functions on subsequent to that section. So our understanding is that having that clause there, the constitutionality of the section itself, that sub K wasn't attacked, but the rule was attacked. It will be up to the rules now to be set similarly. So it will still remain a policy decision for members whether to have the amendment as proposed. And just to note that the court did state that in concluding that there is a Rule 25 unconstitutionality, this conclusion does not mean that the rules of the CTMA must provide for an unrestricted right to legal representation. So the judgment does not say that there is not an unrestricted right to legal representation. And the clause in providing that, including the regulation or limitation of the right to be represented in those proceedings, this amendment, therefore, does not seem to be problematic. It will come down to the application and the formulation of the subsequent rules. And the judge also said that I further express no opinion whether a litigant in such an arbitration should receive legal aid. It comes down to the discretion of the commissioner. So that's just to provide clarity as to the recent judgment, and that this clause remains a policy decision and not a legal question. Thank you, Chair. With Commissioner, and also clause 20,
just before that one, you know, as I'm listening, there's something that keeps on coming back to my mind about what we discussed earlier about the administrators. Is it because I'm studying the company laws, it says... It actually says who qualifies to be an administrator. It will be accountants or lawyers, and not only all lawyers, you know. There will be certain lawyers who have done certain things who will qualify to be that. There's again some form of stipulation for time that the administrator can serve for this period, and then the period could be extended based on if they are outstanding issues. But with ours, I think it's a bit hanging. One, it doesn't say who qualifies to be an administrator. Can you pick make him an administrator of a union? You know? Who qualifies and who doesn't? Aren't they supposed to do those things here? And then, if they are not done here, where are they going to? Who is going to set those principles in terms of reference for those who can serve in such bodies? You know? I don't want to stall discussions, but I'm just saying that let us think about those as well.
When this was put on the table, this was not entirely the same as the administrator in the company's solvency, in the solvency company's act. Because in this case, you could appoint a general secretary of another union, for example. General secretary, let's say it's a quarter union, struggling. Nothing prevents the register saying, another quarter of another secretary, when the court to appoint you to solve this specific problem. And therefore, we wouldn't want to tie the court into these specific people and these qualifications. And it could be the qualification that you need an experience in running trade, you know. That's a qualification that you need, not necessarily an accountant, depending on the different issues that are there in terms of that. There is a precedent in this, the one case in the labor court, not the law, where there was infighting the two parties, the secretary in the organization. One party went to the labor court to remove the other party. What the judge said, he did exactly this, because a judge, the health and children, who was acting, he appointed an administrator, a trade union, a former trade union, that said, you do the following, sort out this problem, and give you this title to do that. As soon as you put a requirement in the law, you say you must be a lawyer, you must be an accountant, you must what, it might not meet the requirement of the problem at that specific time. And he's suggesting that let the register show the court why it should be me, not him. The register will go to court and say, I want the register, this is the person that we think will be able to solve this problem, and this is the problem. If the court agrees to that, and that's the appointment. And it's not necessarily a lawyer, nor a trade unionist, nor an accountant. It could be. But it's not confined to that. It will depend what is the problem with the organization. If there's infighting, the lawyer is not going to solve that. An accountant is not going to solve that. You need someone who understands organization, who understands how trade union work, and the policies of the trade union.
It's not written down here. Anyone can decide that it's for how long. I mean the court. And what kind is the court in doing that? Okay.
I just want to find out from legal minds present here. Amongst other things that you do when you make rules and regulations for the implementation of an act, you want to consider issues like that one. It's just a question from a regular guy. When you make rules and regulations to make it easy for implementation of a particular act, you don't include issues like this. Whether on a particular state of life where there will be a problem, rules and what the rules and regulations with regard to what qualifications for a particular task to be carried out. I'm just asking. Because I need to be educated.
Yeah, who has the question?
I have.
Okay. Then Bush and the other Bushes, Honorable Nyakemba.
My
But Chairperson, you must address me as a lawyer because the question has been directed to the lawyers, they're not responding. It has been referred to us, lawyers. No, I think the explanation from the department in relation to the administrator is that in the law you can't put everything. You can't then say these are the qualifications that are required for an administrator. But I think now the lawyers will correct the Bush lawyer. I assume that there are court rules which will guide the court when they are appointing the administrator. That is the good application that is submitted by the register.
The question of lawyers in Gemba is a very serious one. I was living in an area where there was a land claim, and the community voted for a lawyer who is in the village, and the lawyer was a divorce lawyer. Case of land restitution. So there are Bush lawyers and traditional lawyers. So when you go to traditional court, you need a traditional lawyer. You had your hand up, advocate. A traditional advocate.
What I'm going to say, Chase, in these cases, I mean, as you said, the registrar, in many of these cases, it's going to be the registrar that's applying for putting localization and administration. The union is not going to do that on its own. And the employer organization really might not, will resist. It's rare that a company goes in and applies for it to be put on its own administration. And in cases, it's not going to happen. It's going to be the register. The register will indicate to court what is the problem. He's got to show the court why he's applying, what is the mutual that is not operating properly. And on the basis of that, he's got to say to court, yes, actually, these are the questions of this thing. This is why we select him. It's because he's got these qualifications. Not necessarily those qualifications. It could be qualifications to run an organization. We could, Honorable Nyakem or Honorable also could be appointed. Nyakem could be appointed and put in based on the experience of trade union, depending what the issue that the register wants to deal with. And we think that it's not going to have the register and serve the trade unions where we start to put who should be appointed. Let the court at that stage take that decision. Who should be appointed on and for how long on the basis of the application that is put in front of the court.
Yeah, but the employees who present themselves for administration, I'm not copying, so shut me down and appoint an administrator. Don't they do that? Yeah, and actually, if it can happen that way, if in a union can decide that we want an administrator, no proper company, somebody will say, no proper company can do it too, and say we are bankrupt, we are bankrupt. But anyway, let's not confuse these things. Far results now. For direction, Makubela Masha.
There's one real lawyer here who was just sharing something to us, and I would want the real lawyer again to share with us Bush lawyers. She was telling us about this rescue thing and whatever, and insolvency and whatever.
To the rescue. Let's listen to the rescue.
Okay, I'm just a student, but I'm just from what some colleagues said in terms of
It's called business residence. It's actually not called administration. The company does go by itself and actually say, we think we have these problems, but they do it on the basis of financial distress. So they need to, if they're projecting that within 6 months they're not going to be able to satisfy their solvency and liquidity test, then the company on its own, it can go and say, look, we need help. Then they go to the company's intellectual property commission. And the reason why in company law, why they said a lawyer or an accountant, it's next to impossible to do a business rescue without those people. So that's all I was saying.
Okay, let's get Bambi. Honorable Khanani,
you can't compare a union to a company, because you can compare a union to a business organization, employer organization. I think that should be the difference between the two. And therefore, a union will never buy for liquidation. It will never. And that is not a union, something else. Employers are rich because they are bankrupt. Sometimes it's how to make money. They declare themselves bankrupt so that you can make more money by being declared bankrupt.
Let's get our refund from one time. Bring us in. Who's leading the assault?
Thank you, Chair.
Dr. Lewis.
Thank you, Chair. Our members then, just with clause 20, similarly with the previous ballot or clause that introduced, comes down to a policy decision. Just a note that we are putting in, if they just accept maybe the one clause, a ballot, a related ballot clause, would then also regard as acceptable. If the one rejected, the other should be rejected. And then just to show the link, it is more than one ballot related clause in the bill. Then with clause 21, my colleagues from the department pointed that out, if the committee sets clause 22, then subsequently clause 21, the deletion in the principal act is required, so the acceptance of the one clause then will similarly be required of an acceptance of another, to give it functional, to allow functionality in the act. But there's a legal question there as well. Clause 22, 24, the chairperson similarly as well, no legal issues identified. Clause 25, I'm going to hand over to Advocate Gordon for that one. Thank you, Chair. But it wasn't really a legal issue identified in clause 25. I have to say that there was pointed out that the words four times in that clause was erroneous, and that required an amendment. So we just put it in the working document to show that the deletion of four times will eventually end up in the A list. Thank you. Thank you. With clause 26 then similarly.
Dr. Lewis. Now because you said I'm okay, Gordon, so let's
Thank you. Thank you, so same section, finally, this indication to members that we identified no legal issues there. Then it becomes a little bit more tricky. Clause 27 to 28, we offer to have a discussion regarding the clauses, those of liberty and then subsequent ones, in light of Schedule 6 of the Constitution. Schedule 6 of the Constitution, specifically item 16, says, or read 16.6, A and B, the Commission Chair would just like to read, it's quoted there, but it highlights that there should be a rationalization of courts, and with that including the structures of the courts, the compositions, the functioning, and the jurisdiction. And then that mandate to do that is granted to the Cabinet Minister responsible for the administration of justice. If members look at the Superior Court Bill, we printed out the preamble. Schedule, the copies, I think, are in front of members. In the preamble of the Superior Court Bill,
It is specifically stated that this bill seeks to give, on page 3 of the book, the one the third and whereas. It is before the Justice Committee at the moment, honourable members. Page 3 of the Superior Court Bill, the third paragraph, and whereas item 16.6a of the Schedule of the Constitution provides, so that drives in the obligation to rationalise terms of structure, jurisdiction, composition, and all of that. And then similarly, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the final paragraph of the... And the final paragraph of the preamble is, and is recognizing that rationalization envisaged by item 66A of Schedule 6 of the Constitution is an ongoing process that is likely to result in further legislative and other measures in order to establish a judicial system situated to the requirements of the Constitution. Within that constitutional section, I would also just like to point out that the rationalization draws in all relevant legislation. That's where our concern lies, because the current proposed amendment speaks to the Labour Court, but it's in the LRA. Just because it affects the Labour Relations Act doesn't mean it falls outside the constitutional mandate of the Minister of Justice. We are concerned that in allowing the LRA amendment to drive a restructuring that might impact the constitutional mandate to rationalise, that in doing so, conduct that is unconstitutional will be pushed through. And it's in the schedule at the back of the Supreme Superior Court Bill, reference is made to the relevant LRA, is made to the relevant LRA section, starting with section 151, which is then on page 55, starting with the second note there is section 151, which comes in to clause 27 in the bill currently before the committee. The Justice Committee is also sitting with this bill here, and it is our fear that the conduct would then be inconsistent with the Constitution, because the mandate is not granted to the Minister of Labour, but to the Minister of Justice. The Superior Court Bill, the preamble, specifically links it to this. And in doing so, it might result also in the National Assembly then sitting with two bills in front of it, and one being referred back because it is creating an inconsistency and overselling. So we are advising, based on that, that this falls within the relevant legislation envisaged in Schedule 6 of the Constitution, and our recommendation is that the committee reject for this 27 and 28 purposes. Or based on that.
Honorable Funder Rezende, what is of the standards of the...
Thank you, Chair. May I just ask, do you also speak to your colleagues who advise the committee on that side? Because it seems to me as if this is something which not only us need to reject, but it's also some things they perhaps need to pay attention to on that side, so that it doesn't fall between the cracks.
I mean, this has been with the committee for about 7 years now. Now, how sure are we that they are going to be to do it, to complete this thing before us? And, so let's just check and I will check. Let me see those things again. Honorable Mananela, Honorable Williams, and then I will move on then.
Can I make a proposal that we do not deliberate on this this one issue now? We just note as one of the issues that we would like to come back to.
You know, I suggest that we relate back to our initial agreement.
Yeah.
That we...
Doesn't mean we can't ask questions for clarity. But
I'm just repeating what we once said earlier when we started, that we respect the room and then give room to the JSC people to complete their part. But then there were other issues raised that it actually took them more than 7 years to deal with this matter. But if they are committing that it will be done this time, that they are going towards that, we can only take their way. Where was the other hand? Okay, let me give it to Ms. Williams, State Law Advisor.
Thank you. I just want to add that Section 27, what it does, it just corrects the name of the High Court. It doesn't actually deal with the rationalization of the courts per se, Section 27. It changes the name of the court of a division of the Supreme Court to the High Court, which is currently called, as well as, yeah. So it just changes the name, which has already been changed, so this has been done yet. But it's finally been parked, just to point out.
I think it's really correct that we need to pass this. Because we need to look on this section. Let's look just Clause 27. Clause 27 is in the LRA as we speak. Now, the implication of what the colleagues are saying LRA as it is unconstitutional. No, let me finish the point. The issue that Clause 27 raises, Clause 27 is in the LRA as we speak. It does exactly that as we speak. That's what the law does, except that the law talks to the Supreme Court, not the High Court. That's what 27 is saying. As now, it means that the LRA is unconstitutional in terms of that thing. Now, let's go to Clause 28. It's in the Act as it is now. It deals with the tenure, remuneration, and terms condition of appointment of labor court judges. That's what the LRA said. Now, the argument is that the LRA as it stands now is unconstitutional. We disagree with that. We disagree that the changes that are being made here, we could bring again written opinion that shows that there's nothing unconstitutional with the changes that we're making. There's nothing unconstitutional with the law as it stands now. And we don't believe that the section that they're referring to that says, that talks to the Minister of Justice means that they are not specialist courts in this country. If you look on the original Supreme Court bill, it had amendments directed to the Labor Relations Act. And if you look not only to the Labor Relations Act, the Competition Act, to the Competition Act, to all the specialist courts, but if you look at it now, it's different. It does not talk to these issues that we are amending here. And I would think that let's just pause and apply a debate on the issue, because that's the implication of what our colleagues are saying. And we do not think that they have a right in that.
Honorable Jamba, don't talk now, please. We'll give you a time later. Advocate Gordon.
Thank you, Chair. I think there may be a misconception. We're not saying clauses in the LRA are unconstitutional. That's not what we say. We say the fact that these clauses are in the amendment rules, that is unconstitutional. Take the same clauses, put it into the Superior Court's book, it is constitutional. We're saying where these clauses are housed currently, the mechanism to make a law is conduct inconsistent with the Constitution. In terms of Section 2 of the Constitution, it says the Constitution is supreme. Law or conduct inconsistent with Constitution is invalid. As Parliament, if we and as advisors, if we allow this committee to conduct further deliberations to include these clauses in court, that conduct makes the law unconstitutional. These clauses belong in the Superior Court. That is what we're saying. These clauses can be carbon copied into the Superior Court book. It's in the schedule of the Superior Court book. And coming back to the issue of whether the Superior Court bill is before Parliament till 2015, in terms of the Constitution, this committee still cannot, or not literally say this committee, but the Minister of Labour cannot interject in that process.
because the competent lay was the Minister of Justice. But Parliament, subsequent to the Minister of Justice introducing the bill, Parliament can decide to which committee to refer the bill. Parliament can decide to refer the Superior Court bill to the Committee on Labour. That's Parliament's discretion. But the competence to introduce is with the Minister of Justice. This bill did not come from the Minister of Justice, and that's what we're saying. So we're not saying the substantive content of the clauses of our Constitution. It's constitutional. We're saying it's incorrectly placed in this bill. We also want to make the point that the Labour Relations Act was enacted prior to the Constitution. That is why we have consequential amendments cleaning up Section 27 and to make it correct in terms of Section 23. It could well be that much of this bill came into existence before the Constitution. And that is why we have these provisions. So the fact that we have provisions in the LNA relating to the Labour Court, it's not unconstitutional. It may have found its existence there before the Constitution was included. But post the Constitution, our conduct now needs to comply with the fixed schedule of the Constitution. Thank you.
Okay, honourable members, I think it's getting clearer and clearer now, honourable Khanare, because it's actually taking us back to where we started initially when about 3 weeks ago. It's 3 weeks ago. Yeah, when we decided to put this in a parking lot. And then later we took it off the parking and say, now we can engage, it's easier to drop something than to bring something on board. I think those are some of the discussions that we went through here. But now that there's a commitment that somebody's doing something about this and that it is in the pipeline, we hope that by the time we are through, I think they'll be through too, and then we can lift some of the things and accomplish them as they've done. Yes. Honorable Khanare.
I apologize if I'm not as clear. These things as clearly as everybody has seen. I hear what the state law advisors are saying, but what happens to the clauses as they stand? My understanding is that what they are saying is that we cannot amend these clauses because it does not fall within the Minister of Labour. But the clauses as they stand now in the Labour Relations, we just leave them as they are. Because if we don't amend them, it does not mean that they don't exist. They exist. So what are the implications?
What I suggest the change, we need to reflect on this oversight of the process. We need to look at the constitutional provision and get our own opinion to assist the committee in taking this forward. We do not think that our colleagues are correct. This law was amended in 2002. Some of the issues in that setting were amended in 2002. Yes, it was introduced in 2005. They were amended in 2002, in 85. They were amended in 2002. Therefore, all of those amendments arise those issues that have been introduced by the Minister of Labour. Now, we need to just apply our mind on that specific constitutional provision that the court has approved, because it was not part of the discussion last week. Now, we have not had an opportunity. If it was part of the discussion, would all of us apply our minds and come up with position on the issues in terms of competence, and that that's what such a thing
Ms. Williams, state law advisor.
Thanks. Just to say that we will reflect on what the parliamentary law advisor said with regard to clause 28. But clause 27 is not introducing new changes. It's just aligning it with existing legislation. Those changes have already been made. It's called, no longer called the Supreme Court, it's called the High Court. So therefore we're just aligning it with that thing. So that in our view, doesn't fall within the ambit of what is said here in Schedule 6 of the Constitution. So it's well within the committee's power to propose amendments in Clause 27. Thank you.
Dr. Lewis.
Thank you,
Chairperson.
Although my colleague from the advisory is correct that it is meticulous amendment, the reason why we flag it is because it is in fact in the Superior Court book as a carbon copy of what we had on front of us. So it's not just the content, that, but the committee currently working on this may be amending it as we speak. And then you said two clauses that were carbon copies when they were introduced or put before two different committees. But you will have the Justice Committee speaking with one night and Honourable Vicky maybe putting a comma or an and or something in because the same bill and moving it another way and then you have two conflict images. The reason why we flag is because it is in the Superior Court and the preamble of that bill says that the purpose of this bill is to rationalize and align. So just to clarify that we did not flag it for technicality, but we flagged it for inclusion in the Superior Court or as it stands. Thank you, Chair.
You seem like you're about to have a heart attack. Can you, let me give you this chance and then I'll give over to the members. They had an issue to say something.
I just want to clarify, one of them is looking on the issue of whether this is dealt with in the constitutional, in the Super Court bill, here we dealt with, and we saw. We have to look at the constitutional. If that passes before this one, then this falls off. Dealt with that one. The issue here now is that our colleagues are saying this is unconstitutional. It doesn't matter whether it's dealt there, against there. They are saying it's unconstitutional on the basis that the Minister of Labour doesn't have authority to reduce bills dealing with courts, the Labour Court basically. That's the issue with it. It's not because it's dealt with the constitutional court. Then when we raise that issue, then we revisit it today that we have. For me, the issue that we need to reflect on is on constitutionality, whether the clause that is encoded in the Constitution prevents the Minister of Labour dealing with this issue. And that's what we said to reflect on. It's got nothing to do with the fact that there is another bill, because the committee took a decision that says that we have to look at that. If that bill is passed before this one, then this one falls off on those issues. If this one is passed before that one, then when that one comes in, we make sure that that doesn't change this issue, or we can take the provision at that stage. I wanted just to make that issue clear so that we understand what is it that will be considered.
I think we agreed again about packing this thing. But let's talk. Honorable Masrumule. Let me hold the hand beside so that we... It's Honorable Masrumule. There is the only one, and there was honorable again, but it's on both extremes.
Yeah, I was going to say, Chair, because some of us are just big layers. So I was going to say, Chair, let's suspend the criteria and inquire.
Honorable Negam. Okay, no, before Negam, let me give the over to Honorable Mwango.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I also was going to propose to make the same proposal that, you know, the stuff that you are listening to now is too technical. And if these two seats are not agreeing on one principle and they are here to advise us, then we are at a loss. I would actually say that we give them the chance to sort out their disagreement on the technicality of what we are talking about, so that when they come back next time, they are actually reading from the same hymn book.
We have agreed to pack the thing and Honorable Mama, there's no serious clashing. Actually, it's about what needs to come first here, and for me, just a little thing that needs a clarity as we go. Honorable Manamele and then Honorable Negemo.
Thanks, Chair. My point is, I think we must decide whether we are having deliberations on this presentation now. We
proposed as the ANC when we started that we get a presentation and then we make whatever reflections at a later stage. And we seem to be allowing the deliberations to go ahead, and we're quite concerned about that.
Honorable Yagema, covered. We decided when we started that this matter will be kept until I think it remained with us. But I think debate are debated. People want to debate issues, and that you will to give them a chance to do this from the table. So the matter is going to be packed. You wanted to say something?
I want to say that we must decide whether we want to have the debate on each clause as we have been doing, or because I think there must be a decision. What is the decision? And the decision that we get in the presentation, and I'm sure there will be clarity questions that we can allow. But what we worried about is the fact that we're already getting into the discussions, which is what we asked that we not do. We only ask clarity. And when we have the entire presentation, we can then get into the deliberations. So, to be specific, our proposal is that we get the presentation. Where there are questions that seek clarity, we can enter into that, but that we do not enter into the discussions. We get the whole presentation, we'll do that later on.
But my understanding is that this is what we're doing, unless if I'm missing something. The lawyers are giving their legal opinion, we engage with those opinions, but we're still going to go clause by clause as deliberation, and what we debate now, we are not taking them as what we've agreed upon. I think this is the rules that we laid when we first started this meeting. I really don't see any departure from that, except that maybe people are going deeper, and I don't think we should stop people if they want to go deeper. But they can still have a second bite when we get to the clause by clause deliberation. Is there any other hand on this matter? Okay. I think let us take this for today and then move on to what I think that would be. And then move on to the two bills that are the two new ones. We ask the administration here to do quotation. Hey, can we have one meeting? Then that the address for the two bills if we are to take one English language newspaper, Afrikaans, Xhosa, Zulu, Soto, that makes them five. They amount to 75,000 rand. Those advertisements. And that's the newspapers. And if I'm to go daily, the Daily Sun, Isolezwe, Rapport, Mail and Guardian. So that's it, honorable members. So I'm agreeing that we're taking these five languages. We have 400 and something.
Chair, I would suggest that we actually need the administrative staff to get sent to newspapers or media houses as the budget allows. Because let's say we can right now we can agree on the ones that you said, and if the budget still allows, I would say they must send to my Swati newspaper down the Gwanti Port, you know. But let's just allow the administrative staff to spend according to what we have, the pie that we have, and close it at that.
You are as far as it means, you go together with the Zulu and Bosa, and the Rhino was ready there. So I think that everybody is going to change our team back to the team. The team is going to be the team. What is the best thing to do?
How many languages part we did discuss that with Zolani, and the question we had was if we're going to go with three languages, on what basis are we choosing those languages? And from what we understood from our colleagues is that the application will be signed if it's a minimum of four languages. Now we've got here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now once you get to 5, the other question that may arise is how did you choose these 5? Why not this one? Why not that? So it would be a dicey situation where we decide we stop here and don't include these languages. So which is why we brought it to the committee, so that whatever final decision we make sure that we target the right people in the right language, and also to bring the attention of the committee that this is the amount of money of the committee's budget that's going to be used, so that we don't want in the end to find the committee. And then they would ask, what are you doing the money? And he told us that we would have spent so much money. And we were further told that radio is even more expensive, but we didn't venture into that area for long. Thank you.
Okay. My proposal would be, and this is firstly, it's not the first time we're doing public hearings, and that we use the same process or procedure that we used in the past, unless there are special circumstances which compels the committee secretary to ask us to have a deliberation on this item. So all I'm saying is let's do as we did in the past. Yeah, thank you.
I think this would be I think it makes a lot of sense. Let's do it that way. Because there was actually a suggestion that we do it that way earlier. But the problem is that we cannot get hold of the person who was running the committee before. But then what I'm saying is that they must just go and look for him because he's here in Parliament. So yeah, then go to his manager and ask him to get to the information. But let's meet again tomorrow. 10 o'clock. Where's the ring?
I don't know.